Job chapter 23 tonight, I'd like to begin reading in verse number 10. Job says, "But he knoweth the way that I take, and when he hath tried me, I shall come forth as gold. My foot hath held his steps, his way have I kept and not declined. Neither have I gone back from the commandment of his lips. I have esteemed the words of his mouth more than my necessary food." You know, those words that we've just read came at a very crucial point in Job's life. You ever had a bad day before? Oh, I've had a few in my lifetime. But I'll sure assure you of this, every one of us, while we've had bad days, none of us have ever had a bad day like Job did. I'm not here to belittle the hardship that you've found. Listen, there are some of you in this room, you've experienced things far greater than what I've ever experienced. I'm not here to belittle your experience. I'm just saying this, compared to what Job experienced that day, we couldn't hold a candle to it. When's the last time a servant comes to your door and tells you that you've lost all of your material possessions? Cattle, livestock, I mean, basically, all of your material possessions destroyed. Job got that via one or two servants. And before it's over with, when's the last time somebody's come to your door and out of breath tell you that all of your children have just died in a tragic fashion? We've all had bad days, but none of us ever had a day like Job. And then, as if that were not enough, Job would be afflicted with a boil from the top of his head to the bottom of his feet. It's one thing when you take a man's possessions, it's another thing when a man loses his health. The accuser is casting down upon Job, and God knows Job's character. And he says, listen, you can touch him, but you cannot take his life. And now Job is afflicted with a boil. His health is robbed from him. He's sitting in ashes, taking potsherds, scrubbing, just trying to desperately get relief. And while all of that's going on, Job's wife says some encouraging words. You know, there are some people that believe that Job's wife said what she said because she was motivated in bitterness when she said, curse God and die. There are other people that believe that Job's wife was motivated by compassion to say, Job, you'd just be better off dead. I hate to see you in such a fashion. And she said, curse God and die. I don't know her motivation, but I'll tell you this. Whatever her motivation was, had I been Job, that would not have helped my heart. His possessions are gone. His family, for the most part, is gone. His wife is in turmoil, and that's where Job's at in the book of Job. Friends come by to encourage him. Job, you've got sin in your life. That's why you're in this mess. And Job's been crushed, and we find him at the beginning of verse 1 of chapter 23. Job said, even today my complaint is bitter. My stroke is heavier than my groaning. Oh, that I knew where I might find him, that thou might come to his seat. I would order my cause before him and fill my mouth with arguments. I would know the words that he would answer me and understand what he would say unto me. Notice in verse 8, he says, behold, I go forward, but he's not there. And backward, but I cannot perceive him. On the left hand where he doth work, but I cannot behold him. He hideth himself on the right hand, that I cannot see him. Do you hear what is going on in Job's soul? He is brought to such a depth. But when you read verse 10, it's like the sun begins to break. And it begins with that adversarial word, but. You know, there have been seasons in my life where all I could think about is, Lord, where are you? But it's a blessed time in your life when you start to wake up and you come to the realization, wait just a second. And I believe in verses 10 through 12, you see very clearly tonight, Job tells us what to do when troubles come. The three attitudes, the three things that we find Job doing in these three verses, listen to me, they're needed just as much tonight as they've ever been. If we could interview Job in heaven and say, Job, how did you make it through that awful chapter in life? I think Job would take these three verses and he would say, these things helped me and they'll help anybody who'll do them as well. Now, the first thing that Job did when the trials came in verse 10 is he made an acknowledgement of God. An acknowledgement of God. In other words, he recognizes, whoa, let's stop for a second. There's somebody in this picture that's far greater than I am. His name is God. And that's why he said, but he knoweth the way that I take, and when he hath tried me, I shall come forth as gold. You know, in our society today, it's more and more on the news. I find more and more articles written about it. You find articles on mental health. You find articles about people who are in despair. You find people that are taking their own lives. Now, I'm telling you, I'm not a medical doctor tonight. I'm not here to just tell you that every last time that somebody has a mental issue, that there's not a physiological problem. I'll just tell you some of that's above my pay grade, but I will tell you this. I know that there are a lot of people in despair tonight in this country, and I dare say even in this state and in this city, because God is not a part of their picture. You see, there's no hope, there's no forgiveness, there's no joy, there's no peace without God. A man can offer his soul and prostitute his soul to the things of this world, but he will always come up empty. But isn't it amazing that Job's soul was able to endure the harshest trials when he said, but he, speaking of God, he acknowledged God. Amen. I'm going to tell you, Christian, your picture is going to be dark when you forget about God. When you begin to rely on your power and you forget God's power, listen, there's no comparison. Your power can open the door, but God's power can speak the worlds into existence. But he says, but he knoweth the way that I take, and when he hath tried me, I shall come forth as gold. There are two things that Job acknowledged about God. Number one is he acknowledged God's knowledge. But he knoweth the way that I take. Have you ever met a know-it-all before? Maybe somebody would say, oh yeah, I'm married to one. Don't say that in here. We'll have to do marriage counseling, all right? I had a roommate in college. He was scary. You know why he was scary? I'll tell you why. Because he sounded like an authority on everything. Honestly, I could go to, his name was Dave. I could say, Dave, why does the moon look that way? And he'd give me an answer that was full of hot air, but listen, it sounded scientific. It was dangerous. It was scary. He was a know-it-all. In every conversation, it just seemed like he always had the last word, and it was authoritative, and it was right. All of us have had an individual that we know that's like that, but do you know in reality, there's only one know-it-all in the universe, and his name is God. And when Job was saying, but he knoweth the way that I take, he was acknowledging God's knowledge. He knew that there was somebody that was greater than him that knew more than he did. Now I want to stop for just a moment. And I want to ask you, really, what does God know tonight? Now it's easy. We can say, well, God knows everything. Yes, God does, but you know, sometimes when we speak in generalities, it really robs us of the power of what God really knows. You say, what do you mean? Well, let me illustrate for you in the nation of Israel. In the book of Exodus, chapter 3 and verse 7, the Bible says, and the Lord said, I have surely seen the affliction of my people which are in Egypt. In other words, in Exodus chapter 3, God looks down from heaven and he sees that his people are hurting. He saw every lash that went upon their backs. He saw every harsh action of a taskmaster. You know what? God saw the affliction of his people, and listen to me, God sees your affliction as well. God doesn't look down tonight and say, oh, I forgot all about him tucked away in Wilmington, Delaware. No, he sees it. He saw the affliction of his people. And then he continues on in verse 7 of Exodus 3, and have heard their cry by reason of their taskmasters. God not only saw the pain, the affliction that they were enduring, but God heard their cry. He heard every weeping Israelite mother as she wept as her son was being beaten brutally by the Egyptians. Listen to me, God hears your moan, Christian. God hears it in your heart when you're so pained and words cannot even come out of your mouth. The ears of God are so finely tuned to His children that it doesn't escape His notice. And then the end of the verse, it says, not only did he see their affliction, not only did he hear their cry, but at the end of the verse he said, for I know their sorrows. God not only saw their affliction, he not only heard their cry, but listen to me, he felt what was going on in their hearts. He knew their sorrows. For the child of God that's here tonight, listen, you come to church and you put on your game face so that everybody thinks that you're doing well. And there's a God in heaven tonight that knows your sorrows. Job said, but he knoweth the way that I take. How much does God know? Luke chapter 12, verse 6, are not five sparrows sold for 2 farthings, and not one of them is forgotten before God? You know what sparrows are? Sparrows are not parakeets. They're not parrots. They're not exotic animals that you find in Petco. Do you know what sparrows are? In the New Testament, they were cheap, dirty birds. You say, cheap, dirty birds. Yeah, a dime a dozen. Parakeets are at least colorful. Parrots can talk back to you. But this is sparrows, cheap, dirty birds. Sparrows sold for a few farthings. And he said, but not one of them's forgotten before God. You think on this globe, 7.6 billion people on the face of God's earth. And my friend, if you're a child of God, listen to me, you've not escaped God's notice. In the sea of humanity that is filled with all kinds of things, God looks down and He takes value in you and He takes notice of you. And listen, if God knows not, He knows every sparrow that falls, don't you think God knows where we're at tonight? What all does God know? Psalm 147, verse 4, the Bible says, He telleth the number of the stars. You go to the astronomers today and they take educated guesses. They're always finding a new galaxy. They're always finding a new system. And they're arguing about whether or not Pluto should be a planet over the last 20 years. It's like one year he is, the next year he's not. It's hard to really have much faith in the scientific community with all that that goes on. But you go to the astronomers and they can give you a guess. But my friend, we could go to the throne of God tonight and say, God, how many stars are there? And without any hesitation, God would give us a number this long. He telleth the number of the stars. You think if we went outside tonight and we gazed into heaven and we could ask God the number of the stars and He could tell us without any hesitation, don't you think God knows the way that we take? But that verse doesn't just stop there. He telleth the number of the stars, and get this, He calleth them all by their names. I'll tell you, you know, we're in a church this week, and I'll bet you I could get most of your names right before it's over with, but I'm sure I'd offend somebody. You'd say, who am I? And I'd get it wrong. You'd say, I'm not Margaret, I'm Sally. But isn't it amazing? God looks into the universe and He can call any star with instantaneous recall. Not even recall. He just knows it. And He calls that star. And here's what happens though. Sometimes we become disoriented. We become disillusioned. We begin to wonder if God knows where we're at. Listen, if that's you tonight, if the clouds will open up, you take a good hard look at the sky and remember this. If God knows the number of the stars and He calls them all by their names, God knows where you're at tonight. So He says, but He knoweth the way that I take. He acknowledged God's knowledge. God knows more than you, and He knows more than me. He knows everything. And if He knows everything, He knows where I'm at tonight, and He knows where my heart is at when nobody else knows. But not only did he acknowledge God's knowledge, number two, he acknowledged God's purpose. And when he hath tried me, I shall come forth as gold. You know, God has a purpose in everything. I didn't say I know what those purposes are because I'm not God. But he does. When I was a kid, sometimes I'd do something that, just pardon the language, but it was just plumb stupid. It was something that I should, if I'd have been thinking. How many times we said, I wasn't thinking. You're like, that's your parents said, that's the problem. And my dad would question me, and he would look at me. He'd hardly called me by my first name. We had both had the same first name. His name was Alton, my name is Alton. But my daddy would look at me, and he'd say, boy, why'd you do that? And I answered him just like you answered your parents. I don't know. I'm telling you, we did a lot of things, didn't we? Without much purpose. But there's one purpose expressed in this verse that you can take it to the bank. And when he hath tried me, I shall come forth as gold. Proverbs 25, verse 4, it says this, take away the dross from the silver, and there shall come forth a vessel for the finer. It's talking about the purification process when it comes to metal. Several years ago, I made a horrible mistake. I lost my wedding band. I was probably 3 years into married life and took a trip to Roanoke, Virginia, or Richmond, Virginia, and somehow, some way, I lost my wedding band. It was the longest van drive back home because I knew when I saw my wife, I had some explaining to do. And so my wife, thankfully she didn't kill me, I'm still here tonight, but she said, you know what, we're going to get you another one really soon. I put my branding on you. I said, well, that's just fine with me, you know. And so we went to a jewelry store, and we marched in there, and she picked out this wedding band, and I really like this wedding band. It has a comfort band edge to it, so it doesn't dig into your fingers and such, and I really like it. But you know how they made that thing? They just didn't go dig it up in the backyard and say, I need a size 9 wedding band for this fella. No, somewhere, somehow, some way, back in some mountain or some mine, somebody is picking out big, ugly rocks out of a hillside. These are big, ugly rocks that you trained eye knows, but we look at it and we say, that's just ugly rocks. But the miner, he knows there's something inside those rocks, and they pull those carts out of the side of the mountain, and they dump all of those big old rocks into a smelting pot and heat it to an incredible temperature. So much so that those rocks become molten, and now you see on top of that smoldering cauldron, you see the ugliest stuff you've ever seen. It stinks, it reeks, looks nasty. Casual bystander says, what in the world are you doing? That's the ugliest stuff. And the man says, well, wait just a few moments. And they begin to skim all of that old, ugly junk. It's called dross. And they're skimming all of that nasty stuff off. And we're like, can we go home now? This is so boring. And about that time, when they're skimming off the dross, for a split second, you see a shimmer of gold liquid color like you've never seen, and your eyes get really big. You're like, whoa, do that again. And you discover the more dross that's removed from the top, you find all along that there was that liquid pure gold that was underneath it. That's how they refined that gold, but in order for that to happen, that ore had to be heated to a very high temperature. And do you know that just like the metal person may refine gold, God refines us. And I'm going to tell you something tonight. Even after you got saved, listen to me. Do you know there's still a lot of ugly in you and me? Oh, I hate to say it. You say, well, that's not fair. Listen, if I'm going to say it's in you, I might as well say it's in me. It's the truth. There's a lot of ugly in there. And you know how it gets out? God just turns the fire up. You know, there have been times I've gone through episodes and it brought out things in me and I stepped back and said, ooh, I didn't know that was there. That's not good. And that's how it happens. But you know, when those hardships come, listen to me, God has a purpose. He knoweth the way that I take, and when He hath tried me, I shall come forth as gold. I wish I could tell you all the purposes tonight. I can't, but I can tell you this, God does have a purpose. So number one is an acknowledgement of God. How are you going to make it when difficulties come? Don't forget about God. That's when you remember Him. But number two, I believe Job would tell us, listen, if you're going to make it tonight, you need to have an attitude of faithfulness. Notice what he says in verse number 11. He says, my foot hath held his steps. His way have I kept and not declined, neither have I gone back from the commandment of his lips. Now I'll be the first one to tell you, Job wasn't perfect in the sense that his response was always the greatest. There were some times that he was in despair. But listen to me, all along the way, there's one thing that you can't accuse Job of. You say, what's that? Quitting. He didn't. He might have stumbled. He might have fallen down a little bit, but I'll tell you what, he didn't quit. You know, when we face difficulty, when we face those things that press hard against us, there's something inside of us that just wants to quit. We face that hardship. Job said it this way in Job 13, verse 15, though he slay me, yet will I trust in him, but I will maintain mine own ways before him. I think about Paul's perspective and the burdens that he encountered. Listen to me, Paul was beaten. Paul was left for dead. Paul died, for that matter, for the sake of the gospel. But you know what he says in 2 Corinthians 4 and verse 17? He says this, for our light affliction. Now, brother, I'm going to tell you, if what Paul went through was light affliction, I'd hate to see heavy affliction. But here was the thing, that was Paul's perspective. He said, for our light affliction. Now, I love this part, which is but for a moment. Just like that. My son Andrew, when he was about 6 or 7, they discovered that he had a large tumor in his sinus cavity. And they had to take it out. They were afraid it was cancerous. My wife and I were on pins and needles. Long story short, it wasn't cancerous, but it was the first time that any of our children ever had surgery. We took Andrew to the surgical place on that morning. They put that little green gown on him with the little green hat. And he's laying there in the bed, and he's all fun and games until he starts seeing the needle. And they pull out that needle, and they're going to have to put him to sleep. That's the right reason they pulled it out. And I will never forget it. I mean, when they pulled that needle out, his eyes got this big around, and he began to squirm, and he began to fight. The doctors tried. They said, we can't, listen, you're going to have to hold this kid down. Andrew was giving him a fight for a 7-year-old. And I'm going to tell you, one of the most painful things I've ever had to do as a parent was hold my child down while they're sticking that anesthetic needle in him. And they finally get it in. But I can still remember my son crying. I can remember him wailing. But you know what I'll never forget? I'll never forget, as soon as they stuck him with that needle, he stopped. And he looked at me and he said, is that all? I wanted to say, is that all? Is that all? I'm going to tear you up, son. You just put me through one of the most troubling parts of my life and you say, is that all? But I'm going to tell you something. You know what? When we get on the other side and we look at it with an eternal perspective, you know what we're going to see? We're going to see that the prices we paid and the hardships that we endured, we're going to look back and we're going to see that was just but for a moment. But you got to be faithful. You got to be faithful through the pain. You have to be faithful through the difficulty. You know, some of the most afflicted people I have ever met were the most faithful people. Faithfulness is not something that's merely determined by your health. It's determined by your heart. One of the first guys that ever gave me an opportunity to preach to teens, his name was Doug Roberts. He was youth pastor in Burlington, North Carolina, to have big weeks of camp, and he picks up this green-eared, you know, fella that from the mountains of North Carolina and says, "All right, preach to these teens." He just went out on a limb to let me do it. But I owe the world to Doug Roberts, but it was while Doug Roberts was directing that camp they discovered that he had cancer and his body was eat up with it. For 2 years, I watched that man deteriorate physically. I can still remember he was riding up and down the road of the camp. He was riding in his Jeep, and he was twisted and contorted. He was just trying to get comfortable. And I went up to him. I said, "Brother Roberts, how are you doing today?" And that was really a question I probably shouldn't have asked, just out of kindness. I just, you know, it's one of those things you didn't know what else to say. And I'll never forget, with a genuine smile on my face, on his face, he looked at me and he said, "Better than I deserve." And he just kept going on. I watched that man, he went to his grave, listen to me, was just faithful. He did what he could all the way. Listen to me, those are the people that are going to make more of an impact to the next generation than any LeBron James or Michael Jordan. You hear, you say, "I don't have much talent." Well, you know what? We don't all have equal talents drawn out of the barrel. That's God's business, but all of us can be faithful. Be in the place where we ought to be. You know, I can't think of a better illustration in the Bible to illustrate the importance of faithfulness than Joseph. Now listen, if there's anybody, if we could say it this way, anybody who ever got the short end of the stick on multiple occasions, it would have been Joseph, so to speak. Now, we all know as Christians, it was God's providence. It was just not some flukes here. God allowed these things to happen. But imagine with me, here's Joseph. His dad gives him a coat of many colors. Now, Joseph doesn't go to his dad and say, "Now, Dad, I want you to give me something that's going to make my brothers really jealous of me." No, his dad just loved him, gave him a coat of many colors. And those boys see Joseph wearing that, and they're already burning with rage. One day, Joseph's dad tells him to go check on his brothers. He brings back an evil report. He said, "Dad, there's a bunch of no goods. They're not doing right." You know, by this point in life, Joseph's not very endeared to his brothers because his dad gave him a coat and he brings back an evil report. He just tells the truth on how they're acting. And then to top it all off, God gives him some dreams, and when those dreams are told to the brother and eventually to the dad, it makes it look like that Joseph's really somebody and they're nothing. To the point where it's like, "Are we all going to bow down and worship you, Joseph?" And now those brothers are really boiling with rage. So much so that they want to kill him. Now up to this point, what's happened? I'll tell you what's happened. Joseph's daddy gave him a coat. Joseph did what his daddy asked him to do. And now Joseph gets these dreams from God and it puts his brothers in bad light. Joseph hasn't done a thing except what he's supposed to, and now he's about to be separated from his family. The days come that those brothers conspire. They say, "That's it." They throw him in a pit. Some want to kill him. One says, "No, let's sell him." And they sell Joseph into slavery into Egypt. Now let me ask you a question. Had you been Joseph, humanly speaking, how would you have felt at that point in the story? Oh, there'd been some of us pacing back and forth in that caravan saying, "Yeah, God, I listen to my parents and my dad gives me a coat and my brothers hate my guts whenever I tell them the story, the dreams that, Lord, you gave me, and now you allow this to happen? I'm telling you what, God, that's it." But Joseph didn't do that, did he? Oh, he just kept going. He winds up in a man's house named Potiphar. Potiphar not only had a lot of possessions, but Potiphar had a wife that was a wicked, wicked woman. She set her eyes upon Joseph, and meant day after day, the Bible tells us, she tried to tempt him, and she tried to woo him, and one day she couldn't stand it anymore, and she grabbed him and said, "Oh, Joseph, lie with me." And Joseph took off his coat, and he ran in the opposite direction. Potiphar's wife lies on him, and he's thrown into prison. Let me ask you a question. After having a few shakes of what Joseph had in his life, where would you have been at that day? I dare say a lot of people would have paced back and forth in that prison and said, "I'll tell you what, Lord, here, I'm trying to be pure, I'm trying to be holy, and I did what was right, and you let me get thrown into this jail." Some people would say, "That's it, God, I quit." And then one day, two of Pharaoh's servants are thrown into prison. Both of those fellas have dreams. And before it's over with, Joseph says to one, "I got bad news for you, you're going to die." But he says to the other one, "I've got good news for you, you're going to live. And when you get out of here, tell them about me. I want to get out of here." And I'll tell you what, those two boys are hauled off. I'm going to tell you, had I been Joseph, I think I'd have been strutting through that prison saying, "Ha, ha, ha, ha. Whew. Boy, I'll tell you what, it's just going to be a few days, because when that Pharaoh hears about me interpreting these dreams, boy, it's going to be on, and I'll get out of this place." I'm telling you, had I been Joseph, that excitement would have been in my heart, and it went by for a month, two, three. But it's not until two long years later that that turkey remembers and tells Pharaoh. At that point in the story, there's some of us, I'll tell you what we would have done. Oh, we would have muttered under our breath and said, "That ungrateful wretch." It's not every day somebody tells you a dream, the interpretation of a dream like that. And he should have told Pharaoh, "I told him to do that. Where, what, he is in, that's it. God, you've left me in this place to rot. I quit." But he didn't do that, did he? You know the rest of the story. One day, Joseph is elevated in great command in Egypt. Not only is he going to save that nation from the drought, he's going to save his own family when his brothers come crawling on their knees begging for assistance. And eventually Job would be reunited with his brethren, and not only his brethren, but his dad. And there'd be a lot of weeping, not because of hatred and anger, but because of a blessed reunion. Joseph didn't let bitterness into his heart. But do you know what? Joseph would have missed the greatest calling in his life had he not been faithful. I'm not saying that you never feel like quitting. I'm just saying if you do, you're making the greatest mistake of your life. What are you going to do when trials come? You better have an attitude of faithfulness like Joseph, or like Joseph and like Job. The world looks at you and says, "You're crazy." But God looks down and says, "No, you're faithful." So number one, we find acknowledgement of God. Number two, an attitude of faithfulness. But last of all, I want you to see that he had an appetite for the Word. In verse number 12, it says, "I have esteemed the words of his mouth more than my necessary food." Anytime I'm gone, my wife's like, "Honey, what'd you eat today? Are they taking care of you?" And as you can see, I'm well taken care of a lot. She's always quizzing me about, you know, are you getting what you need? But you know, so often we're a lot more concerned about our physical food than we are our spiritual food. Isn't it a shame we go to a restaurant when things aren't quite right, we get bent out of shape, but yet we can leave our Bibles on our dressers every day and not feast on God's Word? I want to ask you tonight, do you esteem the words of His mouth more than your necessary food? I'm talking to Christians tonight. You know, we talk about wanting revival for this country and revival for our churches. And I'll tell you what, perhaps the greatest instrument for revival itself right here in our laps, and it goes untouched or unheeded. What kind of husband would you be if you never talked to your wife, or never let your wife never talk to you? What kind of Christian are we when we don't let God talk to us? You know, one of the dangers for me as a preacher, you know, you approach this book sometimes a little bit haphazardly. You just approach it, okay, I'll read another chapter, but the truth is, I need this more than the food that I eat. And it may be that there's some here tonight, your attitude towards this book, you can't esteem it more than, you've not esteemed it more than your necessary food. Are you in the Bible every day? Are you letting God speak to your heart? The Bible says in Psalm 119, verse 71, "It is good for me that I have been afflicted, that I might learn thy statutes." You know what he was saying? He was saying, it's good for me that I've experienced hardship. It's driven me to the Bible, and it's caused me to understand it more. Psalm 119, verse 92, "Unless thy law had been my delights, I should have perished in mine affliction." He didn't say, boy, if I'd not gotten more money, boy, if I'd not gotten more assistance. He said, had I not been in this book, I would have perished. I would have washed out. And so often we put more premium on the physical food that we eat than the Bible itself. I know some of you have an appetite. You're like, boy, I'll tell you, I like to eat at such and such restaurant. We Baptists, we talk about food, don't we? Sometimes my wife and I, we talk about trips we've taken, and she'll be like, oh yeah, we ate here. I'd be like, oh yeah, we do. We remember things that way. But you know, it's good when we not only say, boy, we ate here and we ate there physically, but you know, it's good for us to talk and say, boy, I'll just never forget when I opened the Bible to such and such a book and God worked in my heart. That ought to be a lot more regular. But listen to me, if you're not in the Bible every day, if you're not esteeming His Word more than your necessary food, listen to me, you're not going to have those kind of conversations. And you can't say that you've esteemed the words of His mouth more than your necessary food. I was preaching in a church in North Carolina years ago, a church that in their church ministry, they are responsible for assembling John and Romans like you folks have distributed here, many thousands. This church would meet together multiple times every year, and they would put together John and Romans, assemble them, and ship them all over the world. In this particular church, I asked this question in an invitation one night. I said, how many of you in this church, and this is a church of about 200 people, I said, how many of you in this church can say that you read the Bible every day? Now, I'm not the kind of guy that says, you know, well, if you've been sick and you didn't read the Bible, gotcha. I'm not that kind of guy. But I said, how many of you would say over the last month you've been able to say that you've been in the Bible every day on a regular basis? Do you know in that church of 200, you know how many raised their hands? Six. And you know what I thought? I thought, here's a church that's putting the Bible out all over the world, and yet it's not impacting them at home. I don't care tonight whether you're 14 or whether you're 40 or whether you're 60. Listen, if you're a child of God, you ought to be in this book every day. Job, how in the world did you make it? He would have said, I acknowledged God. I had an attitude of faithfulness. He'd say, I'd had an appetite for the Word. Amen. And you know what? The same thing that helped Job thousands of years ago, I've got news for you. It'll help you tonight. If you'll follow the same path that Job did. Let's bow our heads together in prayer.